All right, well, thank you everyone for attending today. We're going to go ahead and get started now. If you're attending this webinar, it is for the Scholar in Residence program with a focus on minority-serving institutions. So we are so glad to have you here. My name is Sarah Causer. I'm an outreach and recruitment analyst here at IIE, and I'm joined today by some various colleagues who I'll kind of go around and let them introduce themselves. So first we'll start with my colleague, Kaylee.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kaylee Smasniak. I'm a placement advisor here at IIE, and I work with the Fulbright Visiting Scholars and Foreign Students.
Wonderful. And next, I will pass it off to David Levin at the Department of State.
So this is David Levin. I'm with the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the Department of State and work on a number of Fulbright programs, including Scholar in Residence, and thank you for tuning in.
Perfect. And last but certainly not least, I want to hand it over to two of our wonderful panelists who are coming from Texas State University. We will start with Dr. Elizabeth Bishop.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Bishop. I teach modern Arab history at Texas State University. It's my pleasure to meet you.
Wonderful. And now Dr. Bishop has actually been an SIR host, and she is joined by her current scholar in residence, and I'll let Dr. Gökçay introduce himself.
Hello, this is Gökçay Gökçay. I'm a historian of international relations from Üsküdar University, Istanbul, Turkey. It's good to be with you.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. We're really pleased to have all of these wonderful voices here on this webinar to really give you some insight into this program. Before we get started, I just want to do some light housekeeping, just to let you know how the system works. As some of you may have already found out, there is a chat box function throughout the webinar. Feel free to submit questions for any of the panelists on today's webinar. We'll have a section dedicated at the end for those questions. And additionally, the session is being recorded. So within about 2 to 3 business days, it will be online. But as long as you are attending, as soon as that is done, I will be sending out an email that gives you a link to the recording. And additionally, we have a various amount of other recordings that are available online. So moving right on ahead, this slide is really just to give you an overview of what you will be experiencing today. So we will start with just a quick overview of the Scholar in Residence program. We'll go into some of the application components and tools. That will be led by my colleague Kaylee. And then we will follow up with some information straight from Texas State University about their experience hosting through the Scholar in Residence program, followed by just a couple more slides of other opportunities within the Fulbright family, and we'll wrap it up at the very end with those questions and answers. So moving on, the Fulbright Scholar Program was established in 1946 by a junior senator named J. William Fulbright. This program has been a wonderful opportunity for almost 400,000 alumni across the different types of Fulbright to engage in people-to-people relations. So this program was really designed to help strengthen the relationship between the people of the United States and the people of the rest of the world. So we always like to really drive home the point that this is really a public diplomacy program, and we really just like to emphasize that. This program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and it has been administered by the Institute of International Education, and we've been really excited for that partnership between our programs. So you are here to learn about the Scholar in Residence program. This program allows you as a U.S. institution to host visiting scholars from overseas for either a semester or a full academic year. It is self-proposed, so in the application, which Kaylee will discuss, you really emphasize, you know, what country you wish to host, what subject, what discipline, and these scholars actually come and teach at the undergraduate level full courses. So typically, Kaylee will talk about it, but I believe it's around 2 courses per semester. She will dive into that a little bit more. But these scholars can either provide an international perspective to courses you're already offering on campus, or you can work with them to develop a new course or curriculum that you wish to really integrate into your campus. The applications, if you're interested, the deadline is October 15th, and it's through an online system that you would submit it, and again, Kaylee will run through those components, But another thing that we like to point out is something unique to this program that you might not see across all programs is we do allow institutions to submit draft proposals up until October 1st. And Kaylee and I will actually look at those proposals to offer some feedback on how to strengthen applications. So those are two kind of dates that you might want to jot down or keep in the back of your mind as we move forward. The email, if you wish to contact us at all, is fir@iie.org on this webpage, and we'll probably reference it throughout. So moving on, there are many benefits that you might be wondering how the Scholar in Residence can actually impact your campus. I'm actually going to pass over the microphone to David to really highlight these benefits.
Sarah, thanks. So SIR, we think, is unique because the fact that it's institutionally driven means, as Sarah said, you determine what the scholar will do. What will they teach? What courses? How will they engage across the campus beyond the courses that they're teaching? How will they engage with your local community outside of campus? All towards the focus of internationalization. So you're really gaining from the scholar coming to your campus, and the scholar is really benefiting from working with you and learning from you. Because this is institutionally driven, we talk about the fact that you, in a sense, are designing the blueprint as to what the scholar will do. So it really is a win-win situation because you've thought through in advance how you're going to utilize that scholar. So it's really a full plate of activities for the scholar once they get to your campus. And we even talk about what will happen beyond the life of the scholar being on your campus. And we talk about sustainability, and we'll go into this a bit later, but even ways that you can maintain contact and connections with your scholar even after they return home, again, all for the benefit of continuing your internationalization activities across campus.
Great. Thanks so much, David. And obviously, if you have questions about ways to really engage with this program, we're more than happy to answer those at the end, so please submit any questions. So, as we said earlier, we have a little bit of feedback.
We'll just mute all of the other attendees, all of the other presenters on the panel right now to eliminate that feedback.
Great. Okay. Sorry about that. So, as I said earlier, this webinar is really intended to engage with institutions that are considered minority-serving institutions. As you can see on the screen right now, that really lists out all those different types of MSIs. Additionally, this program really intends to engage with community colleges, small liberal arts, and rural institutions. So really, those are the institutions we're aiming for. So if this really does apply for you, this program is for you. You are kind of our goal audience. Additionally, if you are on this webinar and you fall outside of those types of institutions, we're not excluding you by any means, but we may ask you to consider partnering with an institution that is. So we're here to work with you, but we just really have to kind of refine those applications to get them to that eligible and competitive level. And additionally, going off of that, we have this lovely pie chart that you can see on your screen right now to really just highlight the percentage of institutions that really are engaging. So MSI is broken down by the specific type of minority-serving institution, but as you can see, they make quite a predominant chunk of this piece of the pie of this program. And before we go on, I just want to actually throw this over to David again, since he is coming from that Department of State's perspective, to really provide any additional insight he has seen over the years on this program in regards to what has kind of developed among MSIs. David?
Sarah, thanks very much. So the reason that we've prioritized MSIs is because we think in general you perhaps are less engaged with Fulbright than other schools might be, particularly in terms of hosting visiting scholars. And secondly, we know that because you're serving, or as you're serving minority students, you know, some of them might be less engaged with foreign audiences than other schools, for example. Maybe you've got, first-generation college students on your campus. Maybe many of them have not been overseas before. You know, this is all toward the notion that says colleges these days need to have some international perspective for their students, for the faculty, for the community, and SIR is one great way of doing that. So we see the SIR program as a way of serving your institutions. If you went back and looked at that donut that Sarah talked about earlier, or pie chart, MSIs there are about 25% of the total number of grantees. We would like to see that increase. This is probably one of the rare programs that you'll hear us say there's actually room to grow from one year to the next in terms of the number of grants that we offer. So we really are looking for more MSIs to get engaged. We think the program really is beneficial to you, and we've clearly seen good numbers of HBCUs. HSI numbers are clearly growing. We've not done a lot with tribal colleges, but I think that's improving, and we have one that'll be taking place this year. We've done some more work with Asian American Pacific Islander serving schools and predominantly Black schools. So I think we're seeing our numbers increase in virtually every category, and as I said, we think there's more room to grow.
Great. Thanks so much, David. And the last slide that really kind of drives home the point that David was pointing out is the list from the 17-18 academic year. As on your screen, you can actually see the MSIs that have participated and were awarded a scholar in residence, and it will say where the country that they engage with is from. So this is really just to show you, you know, what your colleagues in the field are doing and who has participated, and hopefully drives home that you too can get involved in this program. And with that, I will actually pass over the reins to Kaylee to talk about application components.
Thanks, Sarah. So since we really do want to focus today's session around hearing from our colleagues at Texas State, I'll run a little bit more quickly through some of these sections. So just a quick note on webinars, if you want a more in-depth look at the application components, then we held a webinar in early April that's now up on our website that really breaks down all of these components. We'll have another application-facing webinar in May, which is upon us, and then also in early fall as we're nearing the deadline. We'll be online on webinars and kind of hosting office hour style webinar where people can come and ask questions, and then you can come to ask your own questions or just to hear what other people might be working on. So stay tuned for that. Take a look at our website to register. But okay, so the application itself is housed online through a system called Embark. And you'd see upon starting an application that there's a shorter application form in which you'd enter text or use drop-downs, followed by a section where you'd be uploading a number of documents. So we do always recommend that institutions just get in here and open an application early on, just so that you can take a look at what's being asked of you, what you might need to be pulling together. I just think it's so helpful to actually be clicking through the application. And then I'd also, of course, encourage you to take a look at our scholar in residence guidelines to get a really in-depth look at the different components of the application form and, as I'll talk about in a minute, the narrative proposal. So these guidelines that I'm mentioning are linked within this PowerPoint, which you'll be able to click into once the PowerPoint has been uploaded. So for this first section of the application, the form, you can see on the screen the individual components. It's more basic. You're mostly just writing in names and contact information and text boxes, but I do want to highlight just a few pieces. So there are two contacts listed here. One is that administrative official, so anyone who can sign off on affiliation information. And then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these contacts, we really defer to your individual institution as far as how it's made up and determine who the appropriate individual is. So it might be a dean or a department head or a president or anything like that. So just let us know if you have questions. And then regarding program dates, we do work pretty far in advance. So you'd be listing dates in the current open application for the 2019-2020 academic year. We'll be discussing financial support and then the named versus recruited scholars in a minute, but just in this application form section, you'll be listing the very basic information. And then lastly, there's the proposal summary that has a limit of 700 characters. It's a required field, and it really gives our review committee a snapshot of what your program is all about. So it's really helpful to use this section to highlight all of those major proposal pieces that you want us to see on first glance. Okay, so the next slide here, we're going to get into the next section called the narrative, which is divided into two parts, and it's really the heart of the application. So first, we have the institutional profile. That's 4 to 5 pages. And Sarah had mentioned the potential for a joint proposal. So if you go that route, then you'd have 7 to 8 pages since you're doubling the institution. For this section, just keep in mind that reviewers may or may not know your institution. So using this section to give them a better idea of who you are, what you're all about, is really key. So things that you'd include in this profile include just general institutional information, all listed on the screen here. And we do find that it's often helpful to break these pages down by section. So those 4 to 5 pages, you could put in a couple of paragraphs under the mission heading, under the academic offerings heading, and then on down the line. And we just see that it helps make it a little bit more easy to read and easy to write from both your end as an applicant and also from the reviewer's end. That's by no means a formatting rule, just something that we've seen is helpful in the past. So again, in this section, we really want to see how your institution is set up and what you have in place, and then alternately what you don't have in place on campus that a scholar in residence could possibly help with or complement. So this section is where you'd indicate your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives, so describing what you're hoping to gain through internationalizing your campus and efforts, and then also how a scholar in residence specifically would fit into these short and long-term goals. I am going to hand it over to David quickly, and then also Elizabeth, maybe, if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about part one. But first, David, if you have anything to add.
So we're talking about the narrative, part, the top part of the narrative, correct?
Exactly.
So again, as Kelly said, you're telling us about your institution and about your short and long-term internationalization objectives, and bear in mind, yes, this can be for a school that has not done a lot but would like to ramp up what they're doing through SIR, but it also can be for a school that's done a number of things with SIR or with other kinds of activities through internationalization but would like to use SIR as a way of, in fact, going beyond where they are now. Maybe you've got a focus in place on one country. You'd like to do SIR to focus on another country in a region or in another world region. So think about this as a way of both initiating something but also expanding on something that's already in place. And that is to tell us how this would fit within your activities already in place and what you envision down the road. You know, how is this SIR going to help your campus and help your community internationalize?
Perfect. Thank you so much, David. And then, Elizabeth, did you have anything to add as a
panel? What I would add would be an illustration of what David had just outlined. So we here at Texas State are in transition. We used to be known as Southwest Texas State Teachers College, but we're on our way towards becoming a Research 2 university. As part of that, our administration's current Academic Affairs Strategic Plan identifies one of our tasks as preparing our graduates to participate fully and freely as citizens of Texas, the nation, and the world. In support of that, I have, in the past, worked with colleagues in Alcac Library to apply to the Institute of Turkish Studies for a library grant. And it was on the basis of this kind of cross-campus collaboration that we prepared our SIR proposal.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. So that's exactly what we would want to see here, just a little bit of background of what's going on internally, what you're working towards, and any other little pieces that contribute to it. So thank you so much. So we'll move on to the next slide here. So this is the second part of the proposal where you'd show what the SIR program is going to accomplish for you. And Elizabeth, again, after I run through a few pieces here, I'm going to hand this over to you for a minute to discuss this section from your perspective, but I'll just run through quickly. So within the oversight section, you're addressing who on campus will be responsible and then for what during the entirety of the scholar's visit. So you would have already had two contacts identified in that first part of the application that I mentioned, so that administrative official and the faculty associate. So you'd use this section here, this narrative section, to really provide a nice background of those individuals and what they'd be doing for the scholar. So we have seen this oversight section take a few different forms. So there could be just a few faculty or staff listed here. There could also be a whole Fulbright steering committee that engages staff from different college departments or backgrounds. If you're interested in going a steering committee route, then just get in touch with us. We've actually had a host that went this route that helped to present at a previous webinar, so I could connect you with that. And again, all of this is really dependent on the specific college or university, so we just want to see what thought has been put into the potential scholars program on campus and that they and you will be set up for success. So then we have the academic program of the scholar. So here you would talk about what qualifications or background a scholar would have to meet your proposal's needs, and then even delving into the need for the courses themselves on your campus. So Sarah had mentioned this, but we do get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus. We see it on average about 2 per semester. Could already be designed, and they're providing that international perspective, or creating an entirely new course. So no matter which option it is, just make sure that you highlight anything that you can provide in this section, because it's important for those reviewers to understand how much preparation the scholar and you are going to need to put into completing these activities. Also be sure to discuss how the SIR would interact all across campus, even across the community. So it should show that you've really thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. And then professional enrichment. We've been mentioning it's institutionally driven, of course, but we do also want to see where there's potential for the scholar's individual growth. So if you could plan to include them in faculty meetings or attending academic conferences, asking them to join those, you'd indicate it here. And then sustainability. So focusing on how you would sustain the scholar's activities after they leave. And David, would you be willing to provide some more insight into creative ways that hosts have helped to sustain scholars' activities on campus?
Sure. So we've seen a lot of good examples throughout the years, whether it's having your scholar teach courses online after they've returned home, or whether it's actually developing a student exchange program or a faculty exchange program, or even going beyond that and having an MOU between your institution and your scholars' home institutions. We've seen everything. We've seen a variety of things. Even had a scholar who was in the field of economic development actually signed an agreement between his home city and his host city of the United States, forming a sort of an economic agreement to do business and industry activities between the two cities. So we've seen a range of activities that sustain both the connection with your scholar, but also even ways that you might maintain the course, perhaps, that your scholar taught. So maybe your scholar who's adding an international dimension to the course that's being taught, maybe that then remains part of that particular course curriculum even after your scholar returns home.
Great, thanks, David. Okay, and then that last point here, financial support. So you would have, in that first section, that application form that I had mentioned, you would have just listed the basic numbers there. So here, in this narrative section, you'd expand on those and expand and show us what cost share you're able to provide. So cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to think creatively of ways that they can provide it, but it's certainly not required. It will not make or break an application by any means. So it could take the form of a salary supplement or in-kind support. We've seen institutions who have offered, including the scholar and meal plans on campus, providing or defraying the cost of housing, public transportation, or auditing classes. So you would just be providing estimates of what those supports are actually valued at, and then just put all information possible in this section here. And again, David, I'll hand it over to you quickly if you have any thoughts on the financial support.
Yeah, let me make a point beyond what Kaylee has been describing, particularly for MSIs. I know many of you, maybe most of you, are currently receiving funding through the Department of Education under Title III or Title V. And I hope that you all know that, in fact, you can use Title V funding or Title III funding for internationalization activities, typically not necessarily study abroad. You can't send a student overseas with those funds, but you can certainly use those funds for international activities on campus. And we've seen a growing number of institutions who are using, you know, a small portion of the Title III or Title V funds to actually provide a salary supplement or provide in-kind support in other ways for their SIRs. So my suggestion would be to talk with your Title III or Title V director on campus and discuss it as a possibility. And this may, in fact, be a funding stream you hadn't thought about as a way of, enhancing the kind of support that you could provide to the SIR.
All right. Thank you so much, David. That insight is so helpful. And then, Elizabeth, would you be willing to jump in from Texas State's perspective on this narrative proposal section?
I would. The proposal narrative, as it's laid out on the slide, is very clear. The suggestions that I would offer to colleagues, particularly MSIs that are also in the state of Texas, so the other 38 MSIs that are here in the great state of Texas, to make sure to lay out a series of steps in your proposal as to how your selected SIR can be presented to the Higher Education Coordinating Board if, in your proposal narrative, you're suggesting that they become instructor of record once on campus. My suggestion is that the narrative proposal have a clear outline of the administrative steps necessary within your local jurisdiction to get that faculty member on campus as instructor of record. For the ease of post-grant implementation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And that just really speaks to, you know, throughout these applications, we'll want to be sure that the program you're proposing is feasible and everything that you're describing works into that feasibility piece, like making sure that that scholar can successfully arrive and work on campus. I will say we'll be getting into letters of support in a moment, which is where I think that some of these pieces could also manifest. But thank you so much. So now, after the narrative portion, we would then want to hear about the scholar that you wish to bring. So the program allows for two separate tracks. You can either name a scholar or ask for recruitment of a scholar. For naming, you'd be naming a scholar in your proposal that perhaps a faculty member has worked with in the past. And if you do name a scholar, then just outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular proposal this is institutionally driven. So we ask that you submit a CV and then two letters of recommendation for the named scholar. One of those letters should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they are coming to your campus primarily to undertake teaching. And then you'd also want to ensure that that scholar has the required English skills to teach that topic on campus. And then if you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections, then that is no problem at all. You can request the recruitment of a scholar. You would be able to choose two different countries within one world region. These regions are listed on our website, and if you don't see the country of interest on the list, then just reach out to us, and we'll be able to talk through your options and just kind of discuss next steps and if it is a possibility or not. So in the proposal, you would include information about the type of scholar that you would like to see us recruit. We ask that you put in as much detail as possible, since we'll be using any information you put here to reach out to our colleagues abroad and see if they'll be able to recruit a scholar within that specific discipline or specialization that you're requesting. We ask that you would outline any credentials of a scholar if there's a certain amount of teaching experience, for example, needed in order to teach on your campus or any degree requirements. So really anything that helps us to narrow down recruitment efforts. I know that we do often get questions if your chances are better to either name or request recruitment of a scholar, so I'll hand it over to David again to provide his insight on this.
Sure. So actually, there's no preference at all whether you name a scholar or ask for one to be recruited. I would say typically, at least the majority of proposals are coming in with a scholar named, and that's fine. But we also get lots of proposals that are approved for funding with the request that a scholar be recruited. The one piece of guidance I would give you is if you're requesting a scholar be recruited for you, and therefore you can list up to two countries in the same region, as Kaylee mentioned, we realize that that's going to be a little more general because you're not talking about a person specifically, but suggested that you think through that section carefully so that perhaps you've got some language that's in general that says if we had a scholar from Japan or China, they would do X and Y. You might also say if the scholar's from China, they would do X, and if the scholar from Japan, they would do Y. You could differentiate, but make sure that your proposal doesn't lean too heavily into one direction or the other to the point where it's not quite clear for the people that are doing the recruiting that, you know, if this went to China, for example, to recruit, and the proposal had too much emphasis on Japan, it might be harder for them to then recruit for you from the Chinese perspective. So put yourself in the shoes of the Fulbright Commission or U.S. Embassy abroad in terms of their role as recruiters and try to be as helpful as you can in terms of giving them good guidance so that they're able to successfully recruit for you.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thanks, David. And then, Elizabeth, did you have anything that you wanted to add to the actual scholar naming versus recruiting?
I have very little to offer this. We're working with a scholar who we named.
Okay.
It's been a wonderful experience for us because we were able to set our application up to work with this specific person.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So there definitely is that line to walk when you're naming versus recruiting. So again, if people have any questions about where they should be taking their applications, then just reach out to us at that email address that is listed throughout this presentation, and also the number online actually comes right to my desk, so we'll be able to help out. Okay, so next up we have the letters of support. And this section, the letters should directly relate to your institution and what you are applying to do. So at a minimum, there should be a letter from the administrative official. And there is no maximum. So you could seek out letters from different departments across your institution and then also neighboring institutions. So from Rotary Clubs or community engagement centers or high schools in the area, really anything. So this just, again, helps to show that there is excitement on campus and in the community and that people are thinking about hosting a scholar and are ready to host. I will say that if you include a letter here, you're not bound to, you're not just tied to have that affiliation while that scholar is on campus, but again, it just showcases the excitement. So you could always add or even take away from letters of support down the line. And this was the section where what Elizabeth was talking about earlier was showing that you've really planned all the pieces. If there is any kind of administrative document or planning document that comes as a result of working on a potential affiliation, then you could include it here, just again, to really highlight how prepared and how you've thought through the potential scholars of RIVAL. And then lastly there we have the sample syllabi. So we'd like to see what a proposed course entails and just get a sense of what it's about. If you're naming a specific scholar, then as Elizabeth did, you might have insight into what that exact scholar will be able to teach and kind of craft it in a way that can outline their cultural perspective. If you are recruiting, then you can certainly still base it around that professional profile of a scholar that you'd like for us to be recruiting. Okay. So once you actually move forward with the application and click send, you might be curious as to what the review committee is looking for during review. So we do say just really ensure that all pieces of the application and the proposal are working together and just giving a unified picture of what you're trying to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So you'd say what the short and long-term goals are and how hosting an SIR would contribute to meeting these goals. So we really did already discuss most of these pieces when running through the application components. You'll see a lot of parallels between the review criteria and what the actual application components are. But some things that you'll want to think through is if the proposal is feasible within the time period, so just not necessarily proposing, you know, 10 lectures in one semester or anything, or 10 courses. Expand as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement, along with creating a network across the institution for that scholar. And then I think that when we hear from our colleagues at Texas State in a moment, we'll be able to actually see these pieces in action. But again, if you're unsure if your proposal is meeting these review criteria, then send us a draft as soon as possible or before that October 1 draft proposal deadline.
Great. Thanks so much, Kaylee, for all that insight. As we are wrapping up the portion from our perspective of this application and this wonderful opportunity, I have about two more slides that we really want to kind of drive home with you is the review process and timeline, which you can see on your screen, and it's also listed on our website. So in October, as we said, the deadline is October 15th. We will actually take those applications and conduct a technical review just to make sure all materials are there, that you're not missing anything. This isn't to try and weed out anyone. We will get in touch if there's something unclear or missing. We will follow up with that. In December, an external review committee will be meeting, and they will be the ones to determine who are awarded. From that point, it kind of splits in a couple of different directions, and a lot of people are involved. You will be notified in January what the outcomes of the panel is, and at those same times, the Department of State, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, will be reviewing those institutions who have been selected, as well as the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board. So they will both be looking at them, just kind of making sure everything is in order. And at that same time, IIE and CIS will be actually just confirming funding for the different institutions. From then, as those are approved, if you have named a scholar, we will be getting ensuring that they are confirmed and able to attend. Or if you're recruiting a scholar, we will pass those names, those institutions' kind of applications over with the criteria you have set forth to the post or commission that relates to what you have requested, and they will actually start looking for a scholar that really fits that bill that you set forth. Once they have some applications and some scholars that might really fit the bill, they'll pass it back to you, and you will actually determine which one best fits your institution's needs. Then anywhere from April to June, just depending on those processes, grant packets will be sent to the scholars, and then in either fall or spring, whenever you have indicated you want them to come to your campus, they will arrive. The last slide, and these links can all be found on our website and will be part of the PowerPoint online once it's archived, just really show the tools that you have at your disposal to utilize. I cannot stress enough, the application guidelines is a very helpful tool that will walk you through every step of the application process. So 9 times out of 10, any questions you might have will be in there. That being said, Kaylee and I are more than happy to answer any questions you have along the way. As a reminder, the draft proposals are due on October 1st, and we'd be more than happy to review and offer some critical feedback and how to really bolster your applications and make them a little bit more competitive. So please keep that in mind and utilize that resource. And obviously, you can submit before October 1st at any point from now until then. And the last bullet that I really want to point out is that My Fulbright. So if you or anyone else on your campus would actually make a great Fulbrighter for either our core awards, the IEA, the International Education Seminar Awards, you can actually register your interest or a colleague's interest through My Fulbright. So just keep that in mind. And as Kaylee mentioned, we have a variety of other webinars as well as blog posts and other items on the website that might help give you ideas on how to really work your application. And with that, I am more than happy to pass over the microphone to our two guest panelists from Texas State University.
Hello, this is Göksar. I think my input, especially about scholars and residence applicants, is that it's important, of course, to, in a way, to realize the internationalization aspects of this program. But especially, I think applicants should think about how they can, in a way, complement the existing curriculum of their designated host institutions. For example, in my case, in the history department, there were like a diverse array of courses about, for example, Latin America, Africa, South Asia, Southeastern Asia, but especially about the early modern and modern Turkey, there was no course about the Ottoman Empire or the Republic of Turkey. So in a way, their specialization, in a way, should complement and in a way make an international addition to their existing curriculum, and also maybe provide additional global perspectives to their other fields like Cold War. In my case, we co-taught a course about global Cold War with Elizabeth Bishop, and it was important to, in a way, maybe in our case, like depart from that US and EU-centric understanding of the Cold War, and in a way explain the global aspects of the maybe like more than half of the 20th century's history. And in a way, students really have benefited from such perspective. If scholars can find in their fields such a perspective and in a way elaborate it in their application, I think it would be much, much more beneficial.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think that one thing that it might help for our attendees to hear too, maybe in a little bit after Elizabeth provides some insight, is how else you may have brought global perspective to the campus outside of the classroom, too, so outside of those curriculum changes. So, but yes, Elizabeth, would you mind also providing insights here?
I'd be happy to. Do you mind going back a slide or two to show us the component of the application, which is the external letters?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Superb. So I just want to mention this key point that there's no maximum in terms of the number or page length of the letters of support. And I want to underscore what was said previously, that this is an area in which what is presented in the narrative can be operationalized. In our particular case, we were proposing to bring a scholar of the Cold War to this university, and it was important for us that he have opportunities for professional growth while a scholar in residence in a small town in Texas on the highway between Austin and San Antonio. So we reached out to a number of presidential libraries. We reached out to U.S. National Archives filials. We reached out to maybe five or perhaps seven other universities that are within the general I-35 corridor. We did everything that we had the ability to using these letters of support to indicate that if he was in Texas, if he were in Texas on this grant, he would have opportunities to enhance his own research in addition to teaching the students who are enrolled in classes and collaborating with the faculty colleagues who were so interested in his safe arrival.
That was perfect. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. So that also does speak to bringing global perspective to places outside of the campus, too. So thank you so much. So were there any other pieces of the application that you wanted us to turn to, Elizabeth, that you think that you could add to? Or otherwise, we would just love to hear, too, about the program on campus.
Do you want to talk about what you've been doing on campus?
Well, I think for the scholars, it's also a great opportunity to visit the United States and, in a way, engage with the other scholars in their fields as well. For example, I will attend to the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations annual meeting in this June before I leave, and it's a great opportunity for me. And it's also it's very beneficial to, in a way, understand the current, in a way, developments in one's own field of inquiry. So if they make use of these, in a way, opportunities, I think, as Elizabeth mentioned, it's a great opportunity, in a way, to develop your own perspectives and sometimes move beyond your horizon to understand, in a way, internationalize your own field of inquiry.
Perfect.
If I can say something in support of what you've been doing on this campus, I wanted to say that you've been particularly successful in thinking outside the box, in reaching out like beyond the standard teach a class or give a lecture format. So you've co-curated an exhibit hosted in our campus library, Central Campus Library, with two librarians. The exhibit was on the history of the Fulbright program in Turkey. You have introduced a speaker series in which the speaker was the diplomat in residence for the state of Texas.
Yes.
Remind me, what else have you been doing on this campus? Because you've been so busy.
And it's also very important to give guest lectures and talks, invited talks throughout the term. Especially, you know, we introduce yourself, but also introduce your field to the other scholars, because sometimes we don't understand that at some local level, some of the states in the United States, in a way, are not that in a way aware of the existence of particular countries. And most of the scholars are really curious about it, but they don't have the facilities or the, in a way, the people who can inform them about the current events and the past events in those regions or in those countries. So meeting with them in flesh and, in a way, engaging with them and then seeing their perspectives, I think it's crucial. And in that sense, I gave some talks about, for example, the environmental politics in the Cold War, Turkey's, in a way, process of secularization, and into what extent it was a success, and how it was still, in a way, a contested issue in Turkey, and in a way, understanding it without making any oversimplifications about, for example, about the Muslim world or the Turkey in general, and in a way showing it in a much more multidimensional way. I think it's very important for the scholar to, in a way, engage in those discussions with the scholars in the United States.
Absolutely, and it does sound like you have been very enmeshed in just the overall culture of the campus and with the other faculty, so that is great to hear. And we're also excited to see what kind of sustainability measures you have after you leave campus at the end. But we actually do want to give our attendees some time to ask questions. We've had a few streaming in, so we might switch over to those for a moment, and then we can jump back to the two of you at Texas State if you have anything to add later. So we'll just gather those for a moment and just bear with us for a second here.
So as Kaylee is gathering those questions, we just want to highlight one more program, and that is the Outreach Lecturing Fund. As I have been perusing some of the attendees on here, I have noticed some wonderful alumni host institutions that have already participated, and we welcome to continue to participate, but we just want to really drive home this is another opportunity to get your feet wet in the meantime as you are thinking about applying for the Scholar in Residence Program. At any given time, there's about 850 visiting scholars already here in the United States, and they can host you would host a visiting scholar for about 2 to 6 days, really whatever suits your campus. And one thing to note is many of these scholars are still here over the summer. So as the summer is quickly approaching, you might still have summer courses or other types of students on the campus that this might really resonate with. So please reach out at olf@iie.org. I will actually be the one to work with you on that. But this is a really good opportunity to get your feet wet hosting. These scholars come from a variety of disciplines and countries as well, and many of them are scholar in residence across the United States. So the deadline is rolling. We just ask that you apply around a month ahead of time, but if you have any restrictions with that time frame, just reach out to me. And the only stipulation, the scholars, they just can't be in the last month of their grant, but I'd be more than happy to run through the ins and outs of that program at a later date on the phone or via email.
Okay, so some of the questions that we received before the webinar started, which is wonderful, thank you. There's a few asking about country restrictions. So it looks like some institutions are interested in specific countries or regions. So to that, I'll say that we do have the list of regions and countries published on our website that you can access on the page that Sarah just got off of, actually. Oh, there you go. And you can just look there, but again, if you're not sure if someone might be eligible, a named scholar, or potentially recruiting from a specific area, then just reach out to us, and we can talk through all of your options. Okay.
And just to let you know, to find that, you would actually go to our homepage. You would hover over programs, go down to U.S. institutions. This is actually a good segue into finding the website, and then you'll see Scholar in Residence there. This is where you can find a lot of the resources we talked about today. And under application, if you scroll, there is a drop-down button that says, whoops, sorry about that, regions slash countries participating in FAR, and the full list is there. So that's just really to guide you to that resource that Kaylee was mentioning.
Perfect. And then we did have some questions about funding, so mainly around expectations of the host, if they'd be paying full partial salary or what other host expectations there might be. So David, would you actually be able to speak to what we've seen in the past for that in-kind support?
Sure, and I think we've covered this to some extent. We've seen a variety of possibilities, people thinking creatively about how they could support this scholar, whether it's an actual salary supplement, whether it's a meal ticket on campus, whether it's a membership at a local museum or a research center, whether it's funds to perhaps bring a scholar with one of your faculty members to an academic seminar or a conference that's within your state or in a neighboring state. You know, think creatively about, as I said, both the cash support if that's doable, and it may be, maybe it will be, maybe it won't be, but also then think creatively about other kinds of ways that you could be of assistance. And as I said before, remembering also about the Title III and Title V possibilities.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David. We did receive a few questions ahead of the program and via the chat box in regards to, is there a cap on the number of scholars that a university can bring? Now, institutions can host on a variety of years. We do encourage them maybe not to host on consecutive years, but if they do, perhaps it's hosting a scholar from a different country or through a different department. David, I will actually throw this one your way. As have we ever seen institutions from different departments apply during the same year, and how do we take that into account?
Yeah, so we say that you can actually submit more than one application in a given year, but we will not fund more than one application at one time. Having said that, we've had a couple occasions where a school has said we'd like to invite two scholars to campus, one for one semester and one for the second semester. So they've taught consecutively, and in fact their programs were connected in some way, and so that's doable too. So the one thing we would say is we wouldn't have two scholars on campus at the same time.
Okay. Thanks, David. We've had a few questions also about how a nonprofit organization could get involved with this program. So to that, I'd say that letters of support section that we mentioned. Throw your hat in the ring as one of the potential partners while a scholar is on campus, and that could be a really wonderful way to internationalize your own organization if that's the aim, and also to just bring a new perspective, new expertise. So I'd say just get in touch with an institution in your area. Let us know if you have any more questions about this. But that is really great to see. So we like seeing that too.
Awesome. We also have one question from, it looks like a visiting scholar who is on this. We welcome you for attending. However, just keep in mind that the program is institutionally driven, but they have a question on how they can actually engage from their end. Kaylee, do you have any thoughts for how maybe a scholar on their end could really work to identify maybe someone to host them?
Yeah, so I guess we could look at this from a discipline perspective. We do see any number of disciplines of scholars coming through, but as we've been saying, it really is tied to the institution's needs. So we have seen all manner. There's a lot in social sciences, humanities, but there are also some in the hard sciences or the arts that have really contributed to a host's curriculum and international development and goals. So if you are in the situation where you're a potential visiting scholar, then you can get in touch with us or get in touch with contacts that you have at U.S. institutions in these categories and see if they would be interested in applying to host a scholar in residence.
And one other thing I'll add on to the wonderful advice Kaylee gave is you can actually look at scholars from the U.S. that were in your country and maybe make connections that way to see if perhaps they would be interested in inviting you. So that's just one other way I'd say to get in, to really get involved and try and throw your own hat in the ring, per se. We do have some questions about the process of naming a scholar.
Okay.
Kaylee, do you want to?
So I would encourage you to reach out to us at fir@iu.org. We had kind of talked through the timeline after you click submission on an application, but just so that you're aware, we run the application review and with our peer reviewers, and then the named scholars or those recruited scholars run through approvals as well. They'd be applying close to this. We're kind of in that timeline right now, that April, if we could open back up that timeline so that I can show you. But
there we go.
It is run through a similar system, and we would be working with them to complete an application. But yes, they would be working with us, that potential scholar, to complete that and come to your campus. But if you have specific questions about that, then just reach out to us directly.
And I know we are at time. We can stay on a bit longer just to answer as many questions, because you guys are submitting a lot, and they're great questions. But if you do have to leave, thank you again for attending. Please email us with any questions or sign up for any other webinars. But we'll get back to these questions. We have a great one. David, I'm going to send this one to you. Can institutions that submit one joint proposal have a scholar at each institution for the year and swap after the first semester? The clever way of going about it.
So if I understand this correctly, you'd want to request two scholars that you'd share, one semester and one the second semester?
That's what it sounds like, yes.
I think that would work. I mean, it's whether you're applying individually or whether you're applying as a consortium of two schools, it's the same situation. Yes, you could have a scholar one semester and have a different scholar the second semester, but you would want to demonstrate a connection between those two scholars. Otherwise, we would see that simply as two separate applications.
Great. Thank you so much, David. We had kind of a clarifying question from an institution about the number of hosting. If you host through FIR, that does not mean you can't have core scholars from your institution applying. You can still participate in the IAA awards. You can still participate in the specialist awards. It doesn't deter you from those other awards. We just are limiting it to one scholar if you are approved for FIR per academic year. So I just wanted to clarify that real quick. And additionally, we had a question about the presentation slides. They will be online after this presentation is archived, and I will send those out to everyone as well.
Okay. So in keeping with the time, I just want to make sure Elizabeth and Dr. Gupchai, if you have anything to add as we're kind of wrapping up, then feel free to jump in.
Well, I think we don't have anything yet, but thanks for having us. I hope we were able to help.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for inviting us to take part.
Absolutely, and I think it really means so much to have that host perspective on the line, and it's a really wonderful resource. So thank you both so, so much. And then David also, if you have anything that you'd like to add to wrap up to.
And we just hope that we've intrigued you and, piqued your interest, and we look forward to seeing many of you apply.
Great. Well, we'll conclude this webinar for now. If you have any questions, please submit them via email to sir@iie.org. Kaylee and I will be waiting for those questions to come in, and we really do hope you do consider applying for this wonderful opportunity. I know it can be daunting to look at, but the process really does work very smoothly, and we really encourage you to reach out with any questions. And with that, we will release you to go back to your other duties. But thank you again to all of our hosts. We could not do these presentations without you, and we hope you have a wonderful afternoon.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.